is the liminal and liminal qualities of mind. Oh, that's what you read. You haven't come to Chris Collins' workshop expecting something else, or, you know, but. And I guess for me, the liminal territory of mind is just extraordinarily important and very much not paid attention to in our culture. It is paid attention to as we meditate, these territories of mind that aren't so familiar are paid attention to as we meditate. And a lot's written about them in both Western psychology and also philosophy. And it's also a lot's written about them, especially from the Tibetan Buddhist territory. And I don't think we can talk about liminal qualities of mind without also including another Buddhist concept, and that is of impermanence, that things do not continue. Everything that happens stops. Yeah. Everything that comes goes. Wouldn't that be wonderful if our mind actually believed that, yes? So as our mind didn't sort of wake up in the middle of the night worrying about, yes? Or the loss of a loved one, 10 years ago when we didn't say what we wanted to say to them, you know, we're still holding that regret, yes? And then we have the additional commentary that we put on top of that, of being, if only I had known, I'm a bad person, yeah? And the liminal quality of the opening of the mind, which is like, there's lots of different ways of experiencing and trying to describe it, but it's when the normal or mundane mind shifts, makes a shift into seeing, perceiving, understanding, and relating to human experience or our experience in quite a different way. Now, meditation can gradually open those doors. However, life opens those doors so much of the time. It opens them particularly through death and death of someone close to us. It also opens them through illness, accident, sudden events. I think wilderness experience can open them. You know, sometimes we can be just in the company of good people and something shifts and opens. So I think life, who designed life? Well, because I'm not particularly theistic, I can just feel that there's a collective wisdom that is in life, and you believe, you know, it's my way of trying to get a grasp of it. Which actually gives us all of these exercises. So even if we didn't know about meditation or spiritual practice or the sacred, or if we were just open to being life running through us, I think all of these qualities of mind, of reality, of perception, of knowing, we have access to them just through being a human being. So I don't think any of us can avoid being surprised and shocked in life. Having the carpet just pulled out from under our feet, and we thought we were doing very well, and our meditation practice was pretty stable, good concentration, good qualities of expansive awareness, steady, lots of equanimity, really letting go, letting go, letting go, letting be, letting be, letting be, thinking, this is it, this is it, these are the fruits of my practice. And then life pulls the carpet from under you, and you find out where the practice doesn't support you in this new territory. You know, it's where everything that we have done prepares us in some ways to be open to these potential awakening experiences that shake us out of what we can cope with, what we can manage, what we have managed and coped with, what we've met in life. And, you know, I'm indebted to my meditation practice. You know, after 40 odd years, I'm seeing a few rewards. Yeah? I genuinely mean that. After 40 years, I'm seeing few rewards. I'm seeing and realizing a few things. I'm appreciating many more things about the Buddha's teachings. I think he was just amazing in terms of how he decided and what he decided to teach. Now, I thought that for many years, but I'm just, the penny's starting to drop. And I'm not exaggerating when I say, maybe I'm just a slow learner. But, you know, I started meditating when I was 18 years old. I'm 64 years old, and it's beginning to work. Yeah. How many of you are meditators? Yeah. How many of you feel as if it's beginning to show results in your life? And it's with these results in our lives that it gives us heart to continue with the practice. And I think for lots of us, for many years, there are not so many recognizable results as we start to meditate, to practice awareness. And that just takes kind of some sort of trust to keep continuing. I was at a conference a good few years ago with a bunch of Buddhists from all different traditions, but particularly from Tibetan tradition, which is not my tradition, although of course I have a great deal of appreciation of that tradition. And the conference was really about after, in the West, yes, after 100 years of teaching Westerners meditation, why are they not happy? Yeah. How many of you are happy? Good for you. I'm beginning to be happy. I'm beginning to be happy in a kind of consistent way. It gets shaken. You know, it's not secure. It's not forever. But it's almost as if that, you know, there were fewer hands went up about happiness. Yes? About, as opposed to the fruits of the practice. There's some tentative hands. Maybe I'm going to be happy.
Consent.
Yeah. How many of you are content? A few more hands. That's wonderful. Because for me, content is the beginning. It's the beginning of the, you know, it's the goal for many years, and then it's the beginning platform to start to go beyond that. So I'm delighted. So that's wonderful. I'm going to start with something that's happened to me in the last few weeks, which feels as if it may context some of this, because I'm going to be asking you all to do some deep personal inquiry around about impermanence, the liminal, loss, grief, aloneness, and marginalization. Yeah. What a wonderful Saturday. The good news is it may end, or it will end. I remember when I was first introduced to the concept that, you know, everything will pass. And of course, those were in the sort of early days of kind of angst and difficulty and despair and, yeah, all the rest of it. And it used to be a really good thought. Well, gosh, you know, this will pass. And then, of course, it dawned on me that maybe that means happiness as well. You know, and, yeah, I'm a slow learner. But a colleague of mine, I love how he talks about this. You know, people, human beings It is our opportunity to learn through our human condition. And sometimes that is really harsh and difficult. And he says, this too will pass. It may be minutes, hours, days, or weeks, but even this too will pass. Now, I'm not going to ask people to put their hands up if you've experienced depression or mental health issues. But I would hope that these would be, I would be surprised if there weren't some of us in the room that had experienced severe states of mental anguish. And, you know, that can feel like it is forever and it is everything. And there is nothing else. And it will not end. And so those of us in the room who sort of endured prolonged times of doubt and despair and pain and depression of the rest of us, the rest of what makes us who we are. Those long periods are quite often very long compared to the dips that most of us experience in a day or a week or a year or a lifetime. And it's hard enough for us when we're thinking, feeling on a day, that interaction was awful, yeah, for me, or whatever. I wish I hadn't said what I said. I wouldn't wish I hadn't behaved in the way I behaved, or I wish she hadn't behaved in the way she behaved. And then, you know, that running around you for days and days and days, replaying something to try and make it come out different. And of course, in Buddhist understanding, that's proliferation, is the added pain and difficulty that we put on top of it. But it feels sometimes like our woes and pains go on forever. When you're in them, there is no end. So the story I was going to tell was just to sort of hopefully set some sort of ordinariness around this extraordinary territory of mind, which as part of it offers particular qualities of mind that our normal mundane mind finds difficult to know. So qualities such as urgency, yes, it wakes us up to the moment. We've not got forever, yeah, urgency. Sometimes it wakes us up into a different sense of who I am and my inner difficulties are in relationship to the bigger picture. It wakes us up to qualities of awakening in the mind, which goes beyond the normal conditioned mind. So my little story is, about 4 weeks ago, I had just finished teaching year one of one of our master's degrees. And there was a young woman on the course who was very young. She was 26 years old, which is very young to be training as a psychotherapist. She was vital and radiant, intelligent, loving, and beautiful. So a real, real kind of, you wouldn't miss her. And she made some very, very powerful and good relationships with her colleagues and with her teachers and with other people in her world. And a week later, I was in a meeting and I heard that she had died. She had died, she'd been sick the day before, and she died the next day. And that kind of shock. Yeah, there was shock around that because it wasn't expected. Yeah, it wasn't. Nobody had time to prepare. It shook through our community, and it took a lot for people to start to try. And even people were just talking about, "I don't believe it. I can't understand it. Are you sure it's her? How could this have happened? What can we do now?" and then the next layer, of course, is the layer of, and she had her whole life to live, yeah. And she had these friends and this family. But it was mainly just the people very close up to her, including myself, had an experience of, we could not grasp what had happened. I've been around a lot of death, but it's been different from this. And some of you maybe have your own stories of experiences like this. But I watched myself and the community struggle to actually find a way of comprehending and making sense and making something meaningful out of something so traumatic and so difficult. And I think there's a lot of people that are still trying to do that. And, you know, there's little pieces that people sort of dropped in, her mother and her sister and other people who knew her really well, that kind of help context it within the bigger picture, yes? That was in some ways a psychological process. Yeah? It was us trying to context the unimaginable within something that would offer us some sort of sense of meaning. Yeah. Her life was because of, and this and so forth and so on. Anyway, that process is still going on. So that's the first part of my story. And because I was very much in the middle of all of that, I didn't have time for personal grief. I was managing the experience of the community. So in my mind, I was clinging on to the fact that I had a retreat. I had a retreat, actually a retreat immediately, about 3 days after she passed, I had a retreat. And I was clinging on to the fact that will give me the space to grieve, to start my grief, and to be with whatever it is that I need to be with around this. And I do believe that when someone dies close up, it offers the opening possibility of opening into this liminal space. It's, and maybe you'll share some of it with us, with me, and with others. And there was always a kind of, my goodness, I really want to have time to be in this liminal space and to allow my mind to benefit from her death. You know, this is a gift that she's given me, and I know about it from the past, and I want to have the space on my own, on retreat, to benefit from this. It's not unrealistic, a wish. You know, I think most people might have thought something like that themselves. And I thought, and it will be safe, there will be no impingements, this is my space, this is my space for grief. That was my basic mistake. So the next piece, that's 1, 2. So my expectation was that this space, in my mind, was going to be a space to do this. Yep. So already I had reduced in some way the opportunity, the immediacy of really what I was actually in, as opposed to what I was wanting to be in. Yeah. So I had actually given that liminal space already some kind of disturbance, some sort of plan, some sort of, you know, personal input to make it not the space of the unimaginable any longer. So the retreat that I was going to was on an island. And I haven't told many people this. And I was just getting off the little boat to step onto the island. And this is why the wheels on this table are significant. And what I had not realized was that the person that was taking me on the boat hadn't tied the boat up. And we were in quite deep water, and it was Sweden, and it was freezing. And I had all my anorak and, you know, retreat clothes on. And I fell in. I fell into the deep water, and I went down twice. And what I thought as I went down was, this is not a bad way to go. I actually was quite lucid. You know, this is not a bad way to go. However, of course, once I was kind of hauled out and up and back in, the shock set in. And what I was with was a real destabilization of everything that I expected the retreat was going to be about. And what I was dealing with was, again, impermanence, death. Yeah. The complete out-of-the-blueness which this can happen, not just to another person, but of course, to me. And so I'm offering this because it's life's lessons, quite often, that shake us out of our whatever, our safety, our good old life, our wonderful meditation, strong meditation practice, our whatever. And my personal take on meditation is it's a preparation to meet these experiences, as opposed to a substitute for them. Yeah. It prepares us to meet what life has sent us to deal with, as opposed to meditations where the mind opens and all sorts of things happen. I think life is where the mind opens and all sorts of things happen, especially when we are unprotected, especially when it's a shock, especially when it tells you about your own life or the lives of others. It wakes us up, potentially, into a territory of mind which isn't terribly... It's not... It can be wonderful, it can be beautiful, it can be transformative, and I think it's always potentially transformative. But it can also touch into the fear, our fear about being that vulnerable, yeah, being that out of control with our mind, because yeah, we're not in control at that time. It can flood us back into our early deficits, yeah, the child places in us that we thought we'd dealt with, worked with, negotiated. For me, after the immersion, the thing to me dying was not potentially for me the biggest problem. But afterwards, as you go through the sort of layers of the experience, I just hit into some very childhood stuff, very early stuff. Why was I not looked after? Why was I not protected? Why is nobody looking after me now? It was that sort of dependent, young person who couldn't cope with the circumstances. Now, I've said I've been involved in meditation for many years. I've also been involved in psychotherapy for many years. And when that liminal territory opens up, we don't just get the opportunities of a real opening of heart and mind, but we also have our fault line that rattles through it. All of the stuff that we haven't truly addressed. It touches into that place of out of controlness, and how we are in relationship to the out of controlness is what we then have to deal with as that those liminal spaces open up. So I've talked about that as if it's a real, overwhelming, enormous situation, and the situation I described to me was. But of course, these liminal qualities of mind can open up in meditation. But again, we have to go beyond what we can imagine as meditators. We learn to gently, 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 gently come to a place where we can begin to be with things as they are. Yeah, as they are. And so we practice that a lot, and it's incredibly helpful and beneficial. Helps us be with things as we walk through London or life again. But there's possibly a restrictive quality of that awareness-based practice, which of course is addressed in pure vipassana, as it's taught, which is all of this prepares us for that. Yeah? It's not just all about the practices about being able to be with what there is. It's when awareness, you can't do that any longer. It's then, how do you meet what's opening up within our quality of mind, consciousness, perception, deep seeing, deep hearing, deep sensing, deep feeling, deep touching. You know, the deep listenings that start to make themselves available. And some meditation practices really recognize this and work with it. Dzogchen is, of course, one of them, as you know. Sometimes people are able, you know, I've not done a lot of it, but I've done some vision quests, and sometimes, you know, that's another way to open this up when you've gone beyond what you can manage and, you know, you need to ask for help. And I'm going to finish talking in a minute, because I'd like to do some practices. It brings us into territory. Personally, I feel that these places, sometimes called bardos, in between places, thresholds of our mind, where the way that we were and how we knew things and how we understood them and met them is no longer, at least for a time, it could just be a second in your practice or it could be longer, at least for a time, there is a threshold and there is an in-between state where you're not what you were and you haven't become what you're going to become when you come away from that state and come back into being, you know, washing the dishes and not shouting at the children and all of the rest of it. There's a space, and in that space I feel that what contracts people, of course, and therefore closes the space quickest, is fear, because we get scared, you know? In Buddhism, sometimes it's very close to the state of cessation, yeah? Cessation, I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's when your personality factors stop for a minute. So you're not hurtling through being you. For a moment in time or longer, there's a pause where the normal way of seeing, behaving, being, understanding, knowing drops. Yeah? And that state is potentially within every breath, every minute. But when it happens, usually, and of course, it's not our time to do it today, but because we're into the territory of spiritual crisis and spiritual emergency. But usually when this happens, because it is so unfamiliar to us, we just contract and get closed down. Fear is just a contraction at this level. We just stop it, yeah? We just stop it. Some of you are children of the 70s, less than normal, but you know, some of us have opened this territory up through, we have known that this territory has been opened up through the taking of mind-altering drugs, yes? And if you've been part of that culture, you're very familiar with bad trips, yeah? And pleasant trips. And, you know, the work of people like the Groffs and others, you know, who mapped some of the territories of mind when these liminal spaces were opened up, just realized that what what can predict whether it's a bad experience or a transcendent opening experience, which has benefits when we come back into a normal relationship, we are changed by it, is whether or not we contract into fear. And so for me, if we're going to travel in this lifetime, we cannot avoid these times when we don't know how to be in what's happening. And maybe what we can do is develop some love, there's a word, yeah, love towards ourselves and our friends and others, and develop what apparently was what the Buddha was persuaded to teach, how the Buddha was persuaded to teach because of fellow feeling, yeah? Fellow feeling. That we have this feeling for others, that we don't want them to be in pain, we don't want them to suffer, we don't want them to feel afraid. And if that quality of fellow feeling is cultivated enough in ourselves, especially round about ourselves, but that's the most difficult one in Western society, I think. If this fellow feeling sometimes, it's not just metta, it's more than metta. It's just a primitive response to the connectedness we feel as human being to human being. If this is developed, then when these times in our life pull the carpet from under us, there is the possibility of a kind of a reassurance that might at least slow down the contraction away from those qualities of love. And what those qualities of experiential life mind offer us. There are people in our society that live in these liminal spaces for a lot of their lives. And I'm not suggesting that this is a good thing, because we marginalise them. And particularly those with mental health issues, that the elderly are kind of living in the liminal quite often, and the physically challenged, you know, are living on the margins quite often of this kind of norm of a society that we have, and that we impose a consensus of what is normal. We create it, I create it, you create it, and then we form a society around about it, that then when people don't think like us or see things like us or behave like us, we then, those people become outside of the norm in this time. If we look at other societies and times in our lives, and still there are some societies who actually respect and respect the wisdom of the mind which is not consensual. The wisdom of the mind that can see things afresh and can offer up a different kind of wisdom and knowing, as to our normal, in quotes, minds. I was sitting in Pret-a-Manger before I came in. And for me, coming from Dartmoor, that's an exciting experience. All the choices of food for a start, you know. And there was just a woman sitting, talking to herself. Yeah. And she was with her husband, or I assumed he was her husband. And he was just ignoring her and having his breakfast. And I just felt how the little circle of people around her were just moving away, not physically away, but almost just ignoring that there was someone sitting, talking, having conversations, and then saying some things from time to time, which may or may not have been helpful for me to really hear and to be engaged with. And so this, you know, this fear of being estranged and marginalised for really some of the experiences that I would imagine we all have had, you know, is something that coming together in meetings like this may start to, in quotes, normalise. Yeah. So it's these qualities of perception, open-heartedness, vision, real seeing, deeper seeing, become more of the norm. And I'm not suggesting we're all going out there, you know, preaching to the masses. You know, the Buddha, unfortunately, when he was first enlightened and met his colleagues, he said, you know, I am the fully enlightened one. Yes, I am. Yeah. And he said, well, he's got a bit off. Yeah. It's not about. You know that it's not about that, but it's about giving ourselves the generosity, offering ourselves the generosity to know our whole mind and to open to different ways of knowing what is real and what is meaningful and what is mostly unseen and unspoken. And stop there. And just see if there's any, I'd love there to be some input just now. And we'll have a little break after this and then we'll get smaller, yeah, in groups. I'd love it. I mean, is what I'm saying, does it, yeah, hit any bells? Yes?
Can you just define gender? Because even though my name is Tolkien, I know you're talking about
this. There's different ways, but for me the simplest way is going beyond what is our usual experience of mind, knowing, yes? Going beyond, it's like going beyond the threshold of what ordinarily we can be in touch with. Is that okay? Yeah. And, you know, that can happen so many different ways. Movement and dance is one of them, I think, too. Yeah. Is that, yeah. So it's really go beyond our conditioning. Not completely, because we're still in there, but to open up the possibility that what we actually can know about is actually this much, that we think it's this much. And if we open to the liminal, it's limitless. It's non-cognitive. We make sense of it through cognition, but it's basically non-cognitive. It's an experience that is a direct experience quite often. And then it can show itself in, as it sort of steps down, it can show itself in images and dreams, yeah, and sometimes lights and colours, and the normal sense of being separate from each other is diminished, and the normal boundaries that we imagine is between us is diminished, and so, you know, these territories which are said to be very normal territories in meditation. Normal territories in meditation. It's when you start seeing, you know, just experiencing perhaps, you know, people's thoughts, and that can be really difficult. I don't experience people's thoughts, but I sometimes get what they are meaning. It's like the normal boundaries of what we think, yeah, is our personal world, is opened up. Beyond archetypal, beyond, you know, it just keeps opening up. Helpful?
Okay. In Buddhist terms, would you call this mere appearance?
See it again, mere.
Mere appearance.
That's very. I think yes. Yes. But to get to mere appearance, I think there's got to be quite a depth and a capacity of being able to post the impact of the objects, the mind objects that arise within that, yes. The other term that's the same from my tradition is direct perception. Yes. It's direct perception. So it's a quality of the awakening mind.
Yeah. Although when you use the word liminal, you're bounding this to a certain extent. You're not including all of that. You're limiting it to capacity in some sense. Capacity to.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
Difficulty because
it's beyond.
What I'm hearing you say is that liminal is moving towards mirror appearance, but it wouldn't be including all of it because of
the condition.
And the
opening that then usually closes.
Yes.
An energetic opening as well as quite often, as well as an opening of awareness. And it's the energies of it that people find quite difficult. The goods, the high and the lows of those energies. And it's also that people, including myself, get caught up on the potential experiences within that energetic opening. Because of all this thinning through, thinning away of boundary. Yes.
I don't mean to challenge it, but with the falling into the sea, helping you understand something, either about wanting to understand something about your student who had died, or about the student who had died?
That's a very good question. Very good question. I think there was direct perception, but then added on to it, of course, because I'm a human being. It felt like there was a very potential, potent connection of the death experience. I've not added too much more onto it than that. But it some sort of level, it felt as if I needed another lesson. Yeah, I just maybe pushing back in again, and I don't think the lesson's been learned for me. I think I'm still, I don't know if I'm up for too many other, big lessons, but. But the other thing it taught me was, expectations lead to disappointments as well. I was expecting to go for a nice, peaceful, that's what my expectation was. And blow me, that wasn't what was going to happen. That's another lesson. That my imagined what was the biggest, most important thing for me to be with on that retreat, what I thought it was, wasn't what it was actually going to be about. I don't know if you've been on a retreat where you found that, yeah?
Well, I've been on lots of retreats, I don't seem to do many, but definitely the unconscious has opened up in many ways,
yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's all been fruitful,
yeah.
Whether it has felt like it at the time.
Yeah, I understand, yeah. Yeah. But it's seldom what we imagine is going to.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Sorry, yes. Were you angry? Because the guy didn't tie up properly.
Not at the time. Okay. Other people seemed more angry than me. Maybe they were doing my anger at the time. No, I wasn't angry at the time. Maybe coming. I still may hit, I'm slow, but no, there wasn't anger.
Because it's interesting, because you framed it as a story and lessons, and it's all kind of quite dutiful. But on another, as a response, but actually on another level, it's like, why don't we pass it down?
No, and that's not because I'm a good person.
Yeah.
Another dear might have felt exactly like that, but for that experience, it wasn't there.